Just before I read from Ecclesiastes, just a point of personal privilege. Some of you know that I had a pretty scary accident a few weeks ago, and still recovering, still not 100%, but here I am, and I get tired and I get fatigued. So if I need to sit down, this is for me. But anyway, I just wanted to say thank you to those who sent text, phone calls. Some of you came and visited. Some of you sent me books, which is my love language. And just I want to say publicly too, I haven't had a chance to do this. Scott Hinks was with me. I don't know if Scott and Beth are here this morning, but Scott was with me. He's the one who called 911, and then he and Beth were with me in the hospital for quite a while. And then Tom Boone has just been great in being able to call him and say, hey, this is where I'm at. Am I okay? He's like, yeah, you're trending in the right direction. So I just wanted to just publicly thank all of you for that. It's really good to be up here. I'm excited to do it. So thank you. I'm going to read from Ecclesiastes. We're starting a new sermon series that I think will be good. This is Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 through 11. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And I'm going to change things up a little bit here, and I'm going to tell you why. Vapor, vapors, says the preacher. Vapor of vapors, all is vapor. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits, the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things, yet to be among those who come after. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Please be seated. So, I like to do these every once in a while, a little mind experiment. All right, so you can close your eyes if you want to. You certainly don't have to, but what I'd like for you to do as best as you can, considering it's January, I want you to imagine being at the beach. And as best you can, I want you to imagine the sun on your face, the sand between your toes, the breeze in your hair. All right, you got that? I know for some of you that's like your happy place, so it's not too hard for you to imagine it. Okay, now that you're at the beach and you're feeling all that, now I want you to imagine being on your knees and you're working on a sandcastle, and you are. You are working hard at this thing. And maybe you're working with one of your kids. Maybe you're working with just a good friend of yours. Maybe you're by yourself, because, sometimes you just want to work on things by yourself. And then after all of your hard work, after when that's done, you sit in your lounge chair. And you're just sitting and you're relaxing because you're weary from the toil, from being under the afternoon sun. And you're sitting in your lounge chair and you're admiring your work. You've got turrets. Maybe you're one of those folks that put the little flags on top of it. Maybe you've even built a moat around it. And you're in your lounge chair and you're just loving this thing that you've spent all afternoon working on. And now, in the quiet of your soul, as you're imagining this, I want you to imagine your 3-year-old punk niece coming up and stomping on it and kicking it and giggling while she's doing it. And imagine your sister-in-law, who's a first-time mother, saying, "Oh, look at how cute she is. She's just a little sand monster. Isn't that the best thing?" And in that moment, what you want to do is you want to bury both of them deep below the sand. And then, in a moment of maturity, perhaps a moment of wisdom, actually both coming together, you begin to realize, hey, that sandcastle was not going to last. If it wasn't the little niece, it was going to be the tide. That was just going to take it away. If it wasn't the tide, it was going to be the wind. That would just blow it over at some point. If it wasn't that, probably some sea turtles are going to come up and knock it off. The point is that sandcastle, no matter what you did to try to control it, to keep it from being, in order to keep it from the inevitable event of it not lasting, you realize it didn't matter what you were going to do. You couldn't control it. The great philosopher and naturalist Jimi Hendrix, he said, "And so castles made of sand slips into the sea eventually." This is the message of Ecclesiastes. In a phrase, and I promise you're going to get tired of hearing me say this, it's one of some of my family members' least favorite phrase. And sometimes my least favorite phrase. But it's this, what it says up here. Control is an illusion. Trust God. That's Ecclesiastes. Control is an illusion. Trust God. Now, obviously, you noticed that I changed it up when I read it, right? Like in the ESV, it says vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Perhaps in another translation, I think the NIV and some other translations, it says meaninglessness. Meaninglessness, all is meaninglessness. And I think you'll see this too as we move forward over the next coming weeks in Ecclesiastes, that vapor is actually the better translation for that word. The Hebrew word is havel or habel. And look, depending on the context, right? Like that word can mean vanity. But what does vanity mean? Like it comes from the Latin word. And look, give me a few minutes to set this up. I'm going to nerd out a little bit. Hang in there with me. But the Latin word, its simplest meaning, it means empty. And sometimes it can mean frivolous. Sometimes it can mean worthless. And then, of course, the question that we have to ask then is life empty? Is it worthless? Is it a waste of time? Meaninglessness might even be a worse translation because, look, you've heard this, right? You've heard that the meaning of Ecclesiastes is life is meaningless without God, right? You've heard this. I've heard this. I've even, the first time I ever read Ecclesiastes, well, the first time I read it, I was like, what in the world is going on here? But eventually, like, I started to see it as like, hey, Ecclesiastes is this great apologetic, right? It's great for the secular, humanist, postmodern atheist, and to help them see that their life is meaningless without God. The problem is that in the 10th century BC, there were no secular, humanist, postmodern atheists. And so what we have to do is that we have to look at Ecclesiastes and look at it for what it is and what the original readers would have heard in the 10th century BC. Now, not only that, but at the very end of the book, it says this. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. Now, in our 21st century world, the word judgment has all sorts of negative connotations, right? Like, don't judge me, you're so judgmental, all those kind of things. But judgment, it's not just that. Like, when you judge something, you actually bring meaning to it. You give meaning to it, whether good or bad. And so what Solomon, and I think Solomon is the one who wrote this, and I'll get into that later as we move on, is that God looks at your life and every single thing that you do has meaning. All of it. I mean, look, the worst thing that anyone could do, if they were to look at the kind of your life over the years, the worst thing anyone could do is just kind of shrug their shoulders and be like, Like, that is awful. All right, so raise your hand if you're a fan of the Great British Baking Show. All right, my next question is how many of you who didn't raise your hand are lying? Because that is a great show, right? So one of the things about that show, if you don't know anything about it, it's several bakers come under a tent in Britain, and they're judged by two people. And one of their names is Paul Hollywood. And the thing that the bakers are hoping for more than anything else is that they can get a handshake from Paul Hollywood, because they know when that handshake comes out that whatever they've baked has been judged very well. But imagine if those bakers worked their tail off for 2 hours trying to get everything together, and Paul Hollywood and the other judge, I can't ever remember her name, what if they walk over and they look at what you've built and they're just like, that is awful. So the fact that God judges everything we do, it is actually what gives meaning to us. And the preacher will tell us again and again and again that life is full. And that life has a lot of meaning. So just for example, what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to set up the rest of the series. Because it's so important that you understand this introduction, that you get what Solomon is trying to say. So, life is full, life has meaning. So I just want to read a couple of things throughout the book just so you'll hear it. So this is chapter 2, verses 24 through 26. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? To the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. These are gifts. These are things that you're meant to enjoy. Chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all its toil. This is God's gift. This is God's gift to man. 5:19 and 20. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil. This is the gift of God. I could go on and on. I don't want to bore you to tears. There's several more where the point is that life is not empty or meaningless, but it is full of the gifts of God to be enjoyed, not to be used to control. Does that make sense? Life is not empty or meaningless, but it is full of gifts from God to be enjoyed and not to control, not to be used in order to control. So this is why we use the word vapor, not vanity, not meaninglessness. Even you may even notice in some of your footnotes, if you go down to the footnote, it'll say this word habel means vapor or mist or smoke or breath. And of course, the question is well, then why don't you use it? And look, it's been interesting as I've been studying this week and reading different things. Is like, for whatever reason, no one even like the definition of that word that it means vanity or meaninglessness is just kind of taken for granted. One commentator even says that the word probably should be absurd, and then he says this: the reason the word should be absurd is because I don't like the other translations. And so, for whatever reason, whenever Ecclesiastes went from Hebrew to Greek to Latin to English, someone decided to say, "Hey, let's make this word meaningless or vanity," and it's just kind of stuck. And then that's just kind of what everyone assumes that it means. Of course, I mean, I've said this before, it has different nuances, and within different contexts, it can mean empty or worthless, or meaninglessness, but not in this context. And here's what I want you to do. Here's your homework for the week. If you have time, I want you to read Ecclesiastes twice this week. It'll take you 20 minutes each time, maybe 30. And the first time, I want you to read it with the word that's there, whether it's vanity or meaninglessness. And then the second time, I want you to read it, and every time you come across that word, to change it to vapor. And I want you to just see if that changes the way that you understand the book. And the reason I'm harping on this particular word is because it's used 37 times throughout Ecclesiastes. It is the interpretive grid. It is the word for how we best understand it. All right, I nerded out long enough. Thanks for hanging in there with me. Let's get back to the sandcastle. Biblical wisdom, okay? Biblical wisdom is recognizing that you cannot do anything to leverage God. You cannot do anything to leverage this crazy thing that we call life. The inevitable destruction, if you will, to the sandcastle, it's a picture of the inevitable end to us. And what Solomon will eventually say is like, look, it doesn't matter what you do, you're going to die, and you can't control it. Now hang in there with me for a second. I know that might sound kind of like, whoa, hey, like that's not encouraging. And I get that. But what I also want to point out is that the beauty of Ecclesiastes, it's one of these books that is just so honest, and it's so clear, and it's so like, this is what it means to be human. And so in all of our strength and our frailty, our contradicting values, our fears and our hopes and our dreams, like when it says at the very beginning, that in verse 3, which what does man gain by all the toil which he toils under the sun? Under the sun is from our limited perspective as humans. And that we long to know, we long to control, we long to figure things out. And Solomon is saying, look, biblical wisdom is recognizing the reality that you can't figure it all out. And that's okay. Because there is a God that is above the sun. And there is a God that understands your humanity way better than you do. And he's given you these gifts to enjoy. And not to use. And so what you'll see is as we go through Ecclesiastes, he'll turn from these things of nature, which I'll get into in a second in verses 4 through 11. But then he starts to get a little bit more personal. And so at the end of verse 1, he talks about wisdom. And in chapter 2, he talks about pleasure. And in chapter 2, he talks about basically your work and leaving a legacy. Chapter 3 is about the seasons of our lives. And then he'll go on to talk about wealth and power and food and drink. And what he's saying in all those things, that those are not vain things. Those are not meaningless things. They are gifts from God. But what we have to be careful of is that when we start to use those things in order to try to do everything in our power to keep the sandcastle from either being swept by the tide or stomped on. So when we use those things, that's when we fill ourselves with weariness and frustration. So here's the question for you. In what ways do you try to control life? Now look, I realize that's a pregnant statement, right? And there's a lot that we do. But I also know that when I asked that question, there was one thing that popped into your head before anything else did, and I want you to pay attention to that. What's the one way in which you try to make life work? What's the one way in which you try to make sense of the world? Look, the week that I had my accident, it happened on a Wednesday night. On Monday, I was riding my mountain bike, feeling pretty indestructible for a 49-year-old. On Tuesday, I was beating everyone on staff in the session, except for Richard Jackson. And I don't even know why I said that. Like, he's not even here. Like, he wouldn't even have been able to contradict me. But I was beating everyone in Topgolf, eating my weight in tater tots. And then on Wednesday, I'm crumpled in my garage floor, and I can't move my arms and legs. How does that make sense? It doesn't. It doesn't make any sense. And so when we try to make sense of the world, when we demand that other people and things around us try to come through for us, and the harder that we try to hold on and have control, the more it just seeps through our fingers like vapor or smoke or a mist. This is how Solomon is introducing his sermon. This is what this is. This is Solomon, I think, at the end of his life, and he's looking back over things, and he's the shepherd king, and he's trying to tell his people, this is what I've learned. That life is vapor, control's an illusion. And so just real quickly, this is what he does through verses 4 through 11. In verse 4, people come and go, but the earth will keep on spinning. Verse 5, the sun rises, the sun sets, and nothing that you and I do will ever change that. Verse 6, good luck trying to control the direction and intensity of the wind. Verse 7, all water makes its way to the sea, but the sea never fills up. And so the water just keeps going and going and going, and you can't stop it. Verse 8, humanity is like the sea. It'll never be satisfied. No matter what we see or what we hear, it will never be enough. We will never be satiated. We'll never be full. Verse 9. And look, he gets a little cynical sometimes, but again, he's just trying to be real and honest about what life is like. He says, what is, and what happened, happened. And you can't control it. You can't control it with anything new because ultimately there isn't anything new. Verse 10, basically a repeat of verse 9. He just expounds on it a little bit. And then verse 11. Verse 11 is a little bit tricky because it says there's no remembrance of former things. And you might see in your Bible there's a little bit of a footnote there. And it might be translated better as there is no remembrance of former people. So it would read this. There's no remembrance of former people, nor will there be any remembrance of former people yet to be among those who come after. Basically what it's saying is, so chances are you won't be remembered. You won't be remembered by those who come after you, and then they won't be remembered either. And again, this sounds a little harsh, not the most encouraging thing on the planet, but it's just simply being honest about the realities of life. And this, again, this is what biblical wisdom is. It is recognizing the reality of our lack of control. So I'll end with this. It seems then, if that is wisdom, that we can't control things. That we're left with two options. And maybe there's more, but look, I've been concussed, and so I couldn't think of everything. Our two options are this. We can wear ourselves out trying to do everything we can to keep the sandcastle from coming to an end. Or we can enjoy the process of building it for as long as we can. We can enjoy the sand in our toes. We can enjoy the sun on our face. We can enjoy the wind in our hair, knowing that as long as we are toiling under the sun, that it won't last. But we can enjoy the good gifts of being able to put this sandcastle together. And so one author says this, you can jettison your trust in the goodness of God and make life work on your own, right? So in other words, you can say, if this is what life is like, I'm out with this whole God thing. I'm out with this whole church thing. I'm out with this whole Christianity thing. I'm going to take control. I'm going to make life work on my own. Option A. Or option B is you can jettison all of the hope of comprehending and controlling the world and more completely put your faith in God. Those are your options. Now, as we go on, Solomon will flesh that out and we'll see what this works or see how this works. But just for now, leave those with two, those your options. Jettison the goodness of God or jettison controlling the world and trust God even more. Let's pray together. Father, this is tricky. And man, I mean, you know the control freak that I can be at times. And so I want, God, I don't want this to just be some fun, cute little way of understanding Ecclesiastes. I want this to grab our hearts. I want it to grab mine. And just the reminder that even though we can't control things, that you are still with us and you love us in all of our contradictions and all of our frailty. Lord, you love us. So help us to see that more than anything else, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen.